last several weeks, we've been talking about the Beatitudes. And rather than going through and summarizing or kind of tying them all together again this week like I have the last several weeks, just remember that the Beatitudes started out in Jesus talking to those there, and he was using terms like blessed are those, or blessed if you want to use the kind of the archaic King James Version pronunciation of that word. It just seems sort of generic. Well, you know, that's those people, or that's whomever. And at the end of what we talked about last week, at the end of the section called Beatitudes, he changes focus, if you will, from blessed are those to blessed are you. So he made it personal. He said, these things I've been saying, they're for you, you know. And so that was important, I think, to the people then, you know, hearing things about being meek, being gentle, being humble, being persecuted, and how there's blessings associated with that. And those blessings are for all citizens of the kingdom from the days when Jesus was walking the earth, even to us today. Jesus is going to continue in his discussion of citizens of the kingdom, kind of describing who they are, and we're going to continue covering that for the next, at least today, next week, and possibly the week after that. What we're going to talk about today is talking about influence. And Jesus goes on, he's talked about who citizens of the kingdom are, what some kinds of characteristics of their life need to be. And now he's going to talk about how they are supposed to be an influence. He's going to use two different images, if you will, to describe the influence that that citizens of the kingdom, Christians, are supposed to have. He's going to reference it in regard to salt and reference in regard to light. Starting in Matthew chapter 5, starting in verse 13, Jesus says, "You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It's then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven." That's going to be the kind of the text for what we're going to be looking at today. When we look at influence, we think about some of the sayings that either are popular or have been popular, or shall we say common, in the last, I don't know, as long as I've been around, probably as long as most of us have been around that are in the room, and maybe even our grandparents. How about actions speak louder than words? Or, I'd rather see a sermon than hear one. Now, that's not saying that we shouldn't be hearing sermons. Romans chapter 10, we read, how shall they believe on him in whom they've not heard? So it's important that we hear sermons. But yet, a lot of times, it's in our daily walk, in our daily life, we may preach a sermon without actually saying a word just by the way we behave, by the way we act. Some of those people that we encounter, you know, we're not sitting up there with a Bible talking to them about how people should live, but yet they see in our lives maybe something that's missing in their own. And in that regard, if we can influence them, be a positive in their life, even if it's a brief encounter, that's an influence. And so Jesus is going to talk about influences. First, he uses the characteristic, or whatever, if you want to call it, the image of salt. And when we think about salt, what are some of the characteristics of salt? What are things that we associate with salt?
Healing.
Healing, okay, so kind of a medicinal capacity or property.
Preservation,
okay, what else?
Flavor.
Those are three, just, pardon?
High blood pressure.
Okay. I don't think Jesus really went into that. But yes, as I was thinking about this lesson, I thought about some of the things that we negatively associate with salt. High blood pressure. You know, how often do the doctors say, you got to watch out how much sodium you take? You look at the labels on the can, you know, it's lower sodium, it's whatever. So sodium itself, you know, can be a bad thing, but in the context of what Jesus is trying to do, or trying to teach, I don't think he was going there. So we're not going to go there with those. We talked about, and just because of the order I have them in my notes, it's not the same order that you guys tossed them out, but we're going to talk about some of the things about salt. You're right, it is a preservative. It delays decay. In the days before refrigerators, our grandparents, probably some of them, had ice boxes where the iceman would bring a chunk of ice, they put it in the ice box, it would kind of cool things off for a while. And before that, how did they preserve? They used salt. They'd pack something, they'd rub it into the meat, really pack it in there good, so that would help preserve it. The people in the day of Jesus, they understood that. They didn't have refrigerators and freezers. They had salt. And so when he said, you must be salt, they understood that one of the characteristics of salt was it delays decay. They also understood that it's a flavor enhancer. And we're going to get some more into that, to these here in a moment. That it was a flavor enhancer. Even Job, back whenever Job was written, whenever it was he lived, if you look in Job 6:6, Job says, can flavorless food be eaten without salt? Is there any taste in the white of an egg? It's Job 6:6. So even back whenever that was, they understood that salt is a flavor enhancer. Salt has medicinal purposes. I remember when I was a freshman in college at Oklahoma Christian, our biology professor, Dr. Dunn, one of the things he said was, a common occurrence at college, you know, you got all these people from all over wherever getting together, and they're sharing lots of things. They're sharing books. They're sharing dorm rooms. They're sharing colds. But he said, you know, as soon as you start getting the least little tickle in your throat, gargle with water that is hot as you can stand with as much salt as it'll hold. That gargling, you know, is going to kill off that strep or whatever, and that's going to minimize, reduce that issue. There's other aspects of healing, if you will, that salt is associated with. Salt causes thirst. I remember the guys when I was in high school that played football, they would always talk about salt tablets. I don't know, Kurt, you were big into athletes. They probably gave you salt. One of the things that salt does creates thirst. When you get thirsty, you drink a lot. So the salt wasn't in and of itself the benefit. What they were trying to do was keep those athletes from having dehydration issues. So they give them salt, make them thirsty, so they drink a lot. And so that was part of salt. To these people that Jesus was talking to in those days, the majority of them were Jews. So what else was associated with salt? Your husband's not here, so I can't refer to him. But he talked about that in his class. Ed talked about salt being a part of the Levitical sacrificial offerings. Back in Leviticus 2, it says, every offering of your grain offerings you shall season with salt. You shall not allow the salt of the covenant of your God to be lacking from your grain offering. With all your offerings, you shall offer salt. So God told the Jewish people, the Israelite people, salt is an important part of the covenant you have with me. So salt was important. There are even anecdotal references to salt being used as a form of payment. Way back in the days before Jesus even, the Roman soldiers would receive part of their pay would be an allocation of salt. They got a little bit of salt. And then later on, when the Roman Empire was expanding and going, you know, hundreds or thousands of miles from Rome in their desire to conquer the entire world, Roman commanders realized, you know, carrying this big old load of salt is a little bit difficult. So what they started doing is giving the Roman soldiers a bit of money that they could use to buy their daily allotment of salt. The word that was used was salarium, which is the Latin root word of our word salary. So even back in those days, there was you know, the concept of getting paid relates to salt. It was important. One of the sources that I referenced even said that in ancient Greece, slaves were sold oftentimes for salt. The person that had written that article, one of the things that they said was, they speculated on, I couldn't find any other confirmation of it, was that a lazy slave wasn't worth his salt. That's another expression that we've heard that we use. Somebody's worth their salt. They're not worth their salt. But that was relatively common thought process. So we see that salt has been important throughout history of mankind. So when Jesus says, you are the salt of the earth, what kinds of things did he mean by that? He meant citizens of the kingdom preserve. They delay decay. Think about our culture, our society. Is it getting more godly or less godly? Kind of like our discussion there, Bruce. It's moving toward less godly. It's decaying. It's getting worse. So the presence of citizens of the kingdom can help delay that decay by our actions. By our influence with other people, we can hopefully, we should be, slowing that decay. Now, are we going to be able to stop it entirely? The desire is that we could. The reality is, Satan's still out there. He's still working. He's still trying to influence that decay, that turn away from God. Think about Abraham. Back in Genesis chapter 18, he negotiated with the Lord when the Lord and two angels came up to him, and he negotiated with the Lord over Sodom. How many did he start out when he was talking about? Because the Lord said, I'm going to destroy Sodom because it's so wicked. And Gomorrah and the cities of the plain. There were five cities. We think of Sodom and Gomorrah. There were others. But he said, because they're so wicked, I'm going to destroy them. What did Abram do?
He asked him to save it for 50 people.
Pardon?
He asked him if he'd save it if he could find
50
people.
Okay, if he could find righteous people. And he started out with 50. He says, there are 50 righteous. We destroy the cities on behalf, you know, on account, you know, if there's 50 righteous. The Lord said, no, I'll spare the cities if I can find 50. And Abraham kept going back and forth. He was negotiating. He got all the way down to 10. But what happened to Sodom and Gomorrah and those other cities of the plain?
Got destroyed.
They were destroyed. The Lord couldn't find 10 people in Sodom that were righteous. Now, we know of at least 4 that left Sodom. Lot, his wife, and 2 daughters. But even his wife turned around to look and see what was happening. Now, we don't know. Was she missing Sodom? Was she missing the excitement of the city? Was she just curious about, well, okay, now what's going on back there? You know, if you hear lots of noise, sometimes you look and see. Who knows what was going on? She turned and looked, even though she'd been told not to. So the fact that God was willing to spare Sodom on behalf of as few as 10 righteous meant that righteous people can delay decay. They can help preserve. They can help stop bad things from happening. Another thing that citizens of the kingdom do is they enhance flavor, if you will, if you think about that. How do we enhance flavor? If we think about one of the things that's supposed to be a part of our character is the fruit of the Spirit. When you think about the fruit of the Spirit, of love, joy, peace, gentleness, patience, kindness, goodness, self-control, I probably missed one or two in there. If we have those things in our life, we can influence culture. We can influence society. Maybe that influence is small because it's where we are. You know, I personally probably don't have a whole lot of influence in India or Burma or China. But can I influence Greeley? Can I influence Windsor? Can I influence my neighborhood? Maybe the question isn't can I, but why aren't I? And that's not just for me, that's for everybody. You know, how much of an influence are we having with the people we come in contact with. So citizens of the kingdom can enhance flavor before God. Again, how is God looking at society? How is God looking at people? Believe the prayers of the saints in Romans, in Revelation chapter 5 are described as incense. And incense, or the sense of smell, is the majority of the sense of taste. And if we are enhancing flavor, maybe in our prayers before God, we are enhancing the flavor of our society before Him by our prayers being that incense. If we think about influencing society, think about how many of the, if you want to call them, good organizations, things that are helpful to people that we take for granted today, were started by people who were seeking to do God's will. How many hospitals were started by people who were reaching out? They're trying to obey the direction that, that Jesus gave in Matthew chapter 5, or excuse me, Matthew chapter 25, when he talks about, when I was sick, you fed me. That brings to mind the idea of soup kitchens, food banks, those kinds of things. When I was sick, or when I was hungry, you fed me. When I was sick, you visited me. Hospitals, you took care of me. There's a lot of organizations that exist today in the society around us and culture around us that were started by people who had as their goal to be obedient to Christ. Now, they may have not necessarily worshipped or believed exactly the way we do, but ultimately their goal was to do things that God wanted them to do. Be kind, be the Good Samaritan, help people they don't know. Citizens of the kingdom can cause, if you will, create thirst. And if you think about that for a moment, you think, okay, well, how can that be? In our response, our reaction to circumstances that happen to us or around us can cause other people to look at us and go, what is it that that person has that allows them to behave that way? Think about tragedies. People that respond to tragedies, persecution, those kinds of things, if they respond to it, even if it's sad, even if they are hurt by it, if they don't respond with vengeance, and they don't respond with anger, but respond to those things with love, with even a sense of peace, acceptance. Those can cause people to go, well, now wait a minute. If that happened to me, I'd punch them in the nose. But when they see people reacting differently, responding differently, that creates in them a desire to want to at least know what's, you know, why are you doing it that way? Why are you behaving that way? We can create thirst for what we have, that relationship with Jesus, that relationship with God, by our actions. Jesus goes on and asks, if salt loses its flavor, how can it be seasoned? Well, how can we lose our flavor? Impurities in our lives. Back in the day, if you will, back in Jesus' day, back before Jesus' time, there was a couple different ways you could get salt. They could mine it, and it was fairly pure. There was also, I suspect even to this day, places where salt water, you know, when the tide comes in, you know, the water is up and flows into to salt beds, if you will. When the tide goes out and that water has, the sun beats on the water evaporates, and people will collect salt. It's mixed with a lot of other impurities that were in that water. So that impure salt may lose its saltiness, may lose its ability to enhance flavor, may lose its ability to preserve more quickly than a pure salt would. So Jesus asks, how shall it be seasoned? How can we make it salty again? Well, some of the other attitudes, when we talk about impurities in our lives, worldly attitudes and actions can be an impurity in our life. Things like bitterness, anger, cynicism, greed, jealousy, if those are parts of our character, if those are things that we are allowing to influence our lives, that's decreasing our ability to be a salt, a preservative, a flavor enhancer in our society. So in our efforts to be a preservative or flavor enhancer, we need to make sure that we present Christianity in a positive way. People probably wouldn't respond to a negative approach very well. I can't imagine, at least in our day and time, that people would respond well to, they open the door and you point your finger at them and go, "You're going to hell." That's going to put up defenses immediately. Now, based on their lifestyle and actions, that may be a true statement, but that's a pretty negative approach. So we're not usually that callous, that direct in our negative approach, but in our actions, in our lives, in our choices of words that we say to people, sometimes that's the message we communicate in that way. That's how it's received by the people. So we need to make sure that in our approach to telling people about Christ, that we do it in a positive way, an encouraging way. Colossians chapter 4, verses 5 and 6, Paul says, "Walk in wisdom toward those who are outside, redeeming the time. Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how to answer each one." We need to make sure that the way we talk to people, that the way we interact with people, positively reflects Christ. Jesus went on to say, speaking of salt that has lost its flavor, has lost its ability to season, "It's good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men." I struggled with that. It's like, well, I know Jesus isn't necessarily just going to throw us out. So how does that look? Well, if kingdom citizens don't look any different than culture, they don't act any different than culture, if you put somebody who claims to be a citizen, and notice I say claims to be a Christian, next to someone who renounces Christianity, renounces any concept of God, and their lives are identical, there's a problem. That person who's claiming to be a Christian isn't acting as salt. They're not preserving. They're not enhancing the flavor. If in our lives we're not making this world a better place, and it could be just, you know, the part of the world we have a place that we can influence, we're not doing what God wants us to do. We, collectively as the church, and individually as Christians, need to be the ones making a difference. In his book, The Cost of Discipleship, Dietrich Bonhoeffer says, he points out that Jesus never, anywhere in the Bible, calls himself the salt of the earth. He calls himself a lot of things, but never the salt of the earth. He says to the people that are there with him, and to us by extension, "You are the salt." Not "you must become the salt." Not "you have the salt." "You are the salt." He goes on to talk about light and how being a light in the world, that the citizens of the kingdom, it says, "You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand that can give light to all in the house. Therefore, let your light shine before men so that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven." So when we think about light, ultimately, what does it do? A lot of things that it does. It lets us see in the dark. And it can encourage us. Think about when the power goes out, that little flashlight, that little candle light, how that kind of lifts the spirit. It can be an encouragement. Just that little bit of light encourages. How about revealing what's hidden? And while your lights all go out, you know, you try to move around in the dark to find the flashlight, to find the candles, to find the fuse panel, circuit breaker panel, stub your toe, whatever. It reveals dangers. It can reveal what's otherwise hidden in the dark. It can also reveal treasures. One of the things the light does is it guides. Sailors use lights, lighthouses, Maybe not as much now as they did 100 years ago or more. Now they use LoRaN and GPS and who knows what all different navigation systems that they've got available to them. But sailors on the low technology end use lighthouses to navigate. Pilots use lights. You get visual approach slope indicators, runway end identifier lights, navigational beacons that are up on top of water towers that let you know if it's a civilian base or a military base or whatever. So those are some examples of what lights can be used for. And Jesus said, you're the light of the world. But we look over in John chapter 9, and Jesus said, I'm the light of the world. As long as I'm in the world, I'm the light of the world. But here he says in Matthew, you're the light of the world. That brings us two different thoughts. One, as Christians, where's Jesus supposed to be with regard to us? He's supposed to be in us. And if he's in us, where is he? In the world. So he's the light of the world. Difference is, Jesus was a, shall we say, self-sustaining light, whereas we are not. As citizens of the kingdom, we're supposed to imitate Christ. Paul in 1 Corinthians 11, 1 says, imitate me as I imitate Christ. Well, if by that string, what he's saying is, imitate Christ. Be like Christ. I mean, that's what Christian stands for, Christ one. We're supposed to be like Christ. In 1 John 2:6, the Apostle John says, he who abides in him, in Jesus, ought himself also to walk just as he, Jesus, walked. So if we claim to be in Jesus, if we are in Jesus, we should live, walk, act toward everybody else, toward the culture around us, the way Jesus would. Just as the moon reflects the sun's light, that sun with a U, we are to reflect the sun's light with an O. Jesus is the light of the world. All I can be is a good mirror or a good reflector to try to help people to see that light. Light exposes darkness. It exposes, light exposes evil. In John chapter 3, verses 19 through 21, John says, this is the condemnation that light came into the world, or that the light has come into the world. In context, in the passage, we know he's talking about Jesus. Men love darkness rather than light because their deeds were evil. For everyone practicing evil hates the light, does not come into the light, lest his deeds should be exposed. So light, in this context, goodness, exposes evil. So Jesus, in saying you are the light of the world, saying you are the good in the world. You are what's good about the world. We have a responsibility to dispel darkness. There's a story told about a dark, stormy night on Lake Erie back in the 1850s, 60s time frame. There was a big storm on the Lake Erie. And there was a tempest-tossed ship that was trying to make harbor and safety in Cleveland. The captain could see the light from the lighthouse to guide his approach from afar. So he could see that from a distance the direction he needed to go. So he's moving toward Cleveland. He's moving toward safety. He's moving toward harbor. But the thing is, as a ship approaches a harbor, what happens to the water? It gets shallower. There's things under there that can be a hazard to ships. Sandbars, reefs, sunken boats. So there's other hazards that the ship could encounter. And so proper approach to the mouth of the harbor is important. The captain asked the pilot, who was familiar with the area, if he could see the lower lights. Lower lights is what the ship's captains, what the people, that are navigators, sailors, whatever, but that's what they call those lights that identify where the hazards are. So what the ship's captain, what the helmsman would look for, what they would steer for, is that gap between where all those little lights that identified the danger, where they were. So you steer for the place where they aren't to make sure that you can still follow the lighthouse, the big light, to safety. The pilot said, no, I can't see the lower lights. Captain asked if they could safely make the harbor without the lower lights. Pilot said, we must, or we'll perish. The ship ran afoul of an unseen underwater hazard. It was destroyed by the stormy waves. In the investigation after that, the individual who's responsible for keeping the lower lights lit, again, we're talking time frame before flicking a switch and having electrical lights come on, that individual said, I didn't think anybody used them. The weather was bad, so I didn't go out and light them. In our songbook, we have a song. Imagine that, songbook, songs in songbooks. Brightly beams our Father's mercy from his lighthouse evermore. But to us gives the keeping of the lights along the shore. Dark the night of sin has settled, loud the angry billows roar, eager eyes are watching, longing for the lights along the shore. Trim your feeble lamp, my brother. Some poor sailor, tempest tossed, trying now to make the harbor, in the darkness may be lost. Let the lower lights be burning. Send a gleam across the wave. Some poor fainting, struggling seaman, you may rescue. You may save. We're the lower lights. We need to shine. We need to point the way to Jesus, to all those struggling, lost people around us. In Windsor, in Well County, Colorado, United States, everyone we encounter that's lost may be looking for a glimmer of light, a glimmer of hope, a direction. In John chapter 3, Jesus said to Nicodemus, unless the Son of Man is lifted up, turn over there and read this. It says, even so, the Son of Man must be lifted up, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have eternal life. We all know that next verse. Even there's a lot of atheists that know the next verse. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish. Some translations, shall not perish, will not perish, but have everlasting life. That refers back to an event that occurred in Numbers chapter 21. People were disobedient to God. God sent a serpent out, bite the people, people died. Moses prayed. God said, set up a bronze serpent. Anybody that looks on that image that I've provided for you will be saved. That's what Jesus is referring back to in John chapter 3, is that he's got to be lifted up so that people look to him for salvation. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do they light a lamp, put it under a basket, but on a lampstand so that it gives light to all who are in the house. Our light must be visible. Cities on hills, you can't hide them. They're right there, especially at night when they got lights on. They're obviously visible. Lamps that are on a lampstand, again, they're providing light to everybody. They're not, you know, doesn't make much sense to turn the light on and stick it under a box, stick it under a basket, stick it somewhere where it's not actually doing what it's supposed to be doing. So if we are trying to live invisible as Christians, to live life what we might call flying under the radar. You know, we're not making waves, we're not, you know, saying what we believe out in culture because people might frown on it. They might ridicule us. Remember what we talked about last week and the week before about persecution. Blessed are you when people revile you, persecute you, and say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. We need to not worry about what negative things people might say about us as we try to shine light, as we try to reflect Jesus light, point Jesus, point people to Jesus. But why do we do that? He says, so let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. Now later on, when we get into chapter 6, we're going to see, you know, almost what sounds like just the opposite of that. And it's like, wait a minute, Jesus is saying, don't do your works to be seen by men, do your works to be seen by men. But notice what he says in the motivation. Let your light so shine. Now if you take the commas, you take that middle statement out and you said, let your light so shine before men that they glorify your Father in heaven. So, if in a course of living your life, you are doing what Jesus does, what was Jesus known for? Doing good. He went about doing good everywhere. If you're known for doing good, people are going to see that. And according to Peter, in 1 Peter 2, it says, beloved, I beg you as sojourners and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts, which war against our soul, having your conduct honorable among the Gentiles, that when they speak against you as evildoers, again, part of that beatitude that Jesus gave. So if they speak against you as evildoers, they may, by your good works, which they observe, glorify God in the day of visitation. So we are light, reflecting Jesus' light. Or we're to be like, reflecting Jesus' light in our lives, in the things that we do. Ephesians chapter 2, I believe it is, Paul says that that God has prepared works in advance for us to do. So we're not supposed to be doing what we do for the praise of men. A lot of times you watch, I remember back in the day watching Jerry Lewis's MDA telethon on Labor Day weekend. The thing that you'll see a lot of times is, you know, Mr. X, whoever he was, representing corporation, whatever, would be up there on stage and he'd be giving this big check to Jerry Lewis for $100,000, $200,000, whatever, a large amount of money. You know, all the fanfare, they got the band in the background, they got this big fanfare televised, oh, look, this group, you know, I remember 7-Eleven would give a lot of money. And it was, oh, you know, look what they're doing. They're receiving the praise of men. We're not supposed to have that as our motivation. Our motivation for doing good is to be the people who will glorify God, not us. After pronouncing the blessings which the citizens of the kingdom of heaven receive, the Beatitudes, Jesus talked about the influence they're supposed to have in the world. He used salt and light as references. And he didn't say, if it's convenient, be salt. Help delay decay. Help influence or enhance the flavor before God of your society. He didn't say, if it's not too much trouble, you know, be a light to your culture. Jesus said, you are the salt. You are the light. It didn't say it like we have a choice. If we're citizens of the kingdom, we are going to be those things. Individually and collectively. So if we choose not to be an influence, if we choose not to make a difference in our society, in our culture, what does that say about our commitment to God? What does that say about us and our desire to be Christ-like in our walk? Jesus went about doing good. Can we not do the same? Just about to the end of class. Is there any questions, comments, thoughts about today's topic? about today's discussion. I know
are we citizens of the kingdom or subjects to Jesus?
Both.
The citizens versus subjects.
You can be both.
Both. Okay.
A citizen of the kingdom is one who lives under the rule of the king.
But citizens have rights and choices, and like they didn't want to scourge a person or two in the New Testament because they were Roman citizens, Paul, for one.
Okay.
Well, are we citizens or subjects? I liked your answer. We're both.
We are both.
But we're not, we don't have all the rights, say, of a Roman citizen who that we demand. We're probably more subjects than citizens.
We are subjects to the king, but we do have the rights as citizens. I'll kind of throw this out there and kind of in response. Obviously, this is kind of a quick thought. As a citizen, we have a right. A citizen of the kingdom, we have the right to say no. Now, there are consequences with that, and that's the whole point. If we say no, I'm not going to be an influence. There's going to be consequences for that. We can't expect that there are no consequences for that action, for that choice, for that lifestyle choice. Ed? So yes, we are both, I believe.
Thank you.
If we're the salt of the earth, and salt adds flavor, mm-hmm. and also avoids decay,
mm-hmm.
how are we the salt of the earth? What are we supposed to add flavor to, and what are we supposed to conserve?
Well, and again, that's a great question. I believe that in our life, in our choices that we make, we need to be righteous. And again, as Abraham, in negotiating with, trying to negotiate, if you will, with the Lord, what was he saying? If there's a certain number of righteous, won't you spare the city? Maybe we can spare the destruction of a community, of our nation, whatever. If enough people in this now, what's enough? I don't know. 10 wasn't enough for Sodom. But we can't say, well, I'm not going to be because my little bit doesn't help. What if there were 9 righteous and one person in Sodom said, yeah, but people are going to make fun of me, so I'm not going to do it. That person might have been number 10. So each of us needs to, in everything we do, everything we say in life, as light, point the way to Jesus. And as a flavor enhancer and as a preservative, if you will, we need to make sure that we aren't contributing to the decay, contributing to the breakdown of our culture and our society.
To me, it means that, and of course I've said before, I'm very simple-minded, but to me it means that we need to be the kind of people and live the kind of life that adds flavor.
Okay.
A member of the kingdom of heaven, and the preservation is preserving the church itself.
Well, that's going to preserve the church, but Jesus is going to do that. I'm not going to disagree with you, but I think it's more than just preserving the church. I believe it's preserving
the message
of that we have. But
right, that would be preserving the church, would it not?
It would, but the focus shouldn't be just preserving the church. We should be trying to preserve the whole world in our influence with the world, creating the thirst, creating that desire in people to want to have what we have. They want to be. Now, usually when people talk about somebody that's salty, is that a positive or a negative comment?
Negative.
Negative. But yet, what are we supposed to be? Salt. Without being salty. Okay, those.
And also, to Virgil, the Bible calls us soldiers. It says you're soldiers of the cross. And soldiers under authority and under command. And if you choose to be a soldier, it's right to armor.
Okay.
If we preserve the church, what are we preserving?
I'm not racing.
The church.
People.
People. Well, yes.
The people that come to God,
But I think that what we need to be looking to preserve includes the church, but is more than the church. We need to try to preserve. We need to try to delay the decay, delay the destruction, if you will. My personal belief, my personal opinion, for what that's a little bit's worth, is that the day of the Lord, as spoken about in 1 Thessalonians, 2 Thessalonians, of when Jesus is going to come back and say that, you know, basically, that's it. You know, time has run out. Come back with the shout of the archangel. That's not going to happen until there's nobody left that's responding, or will respond. God knows the hearts of men. As long as there are people out there that we can reach, we being Christians, whoever we are, I believe that God's going to allow the world to continue. So if we continue to be a preservative and a flavored answer, continue trying to reach out and save the lost, reach out and preserve the lost, not so that they can die lost, but so that they can be saved. That's my understanding. The church obviously would be part of that, but if you think about it, what would this be? Salt shaker, box of salt. That's the area that we need to influence. You know, salt crystals in a salt shaker aren't enhancing a flavor in the salt shaker. It's not until they get out onto the food that they're doing their work.
Maybe I'm making this too simplistic, but listening to the analogy of salt, it can't be a flavor enhancer or a purifier if it has imperfections in it. You want the purest salt for the best flavor, correct?
Okay.
So church, to me, and this family of people that you go to every Sunday or every Wednesday or whenever you can make it, that's the purifying process so that you can be that light out in the world.
Okay.
I mean, without being a part of that group, how can you then be an enhancement to everybody else that you interact with? That unless you have this interaction.
Okay.
So this is the purifier to make you that salt when you get out into. I guess maybe I'm oversimplifying it, but I think I agree that you first have to have this before you can go out and become that salt.
I would agree with that. Looks like we have a big crowd lining up at the back. I appreciate your comments and your attention today in class. Let's go ahead and get ready for worship.